Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Then we bit the apple and the garden was lost. And so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things.
Yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. That's the wonderful, terrific, beautiful, and spectacular Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger. David Burns, the Rivertown Kids on Tomorrow's Children, the Grammy Award-winning Charles Tomorrow's Children CD, I guess they call them these days. This is Harvey Wasserman. We're back for another hour of the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Got a great show today. Major things to talk about. We're going to talk about nuclear power, as we often do, this time about who's going to pay for the debacle at the San Onofre nuclear plant in California, which has been gratefully, spectacularly, and wonderfully shut thanks to a spectacular California-based grassroots movement. Two reactors on the California coast will never operate again, along with a third one there that's been shut since 1990-something. But these two reactors have just been shut because the owners, Edison, the operators, made a terrible mistake and installed steam generators that don't work. We will talk about that in the latter part of the hour. We also have Tom Clements with us. Tom is a tremendous, long-time nuclear organizer, anti-nuclear organizer. I knew him at Greenpeace. He's with Friends of the Earth now, based in the war zone in South Carolina, dealing with a plutonium facility, mixed oxide fuel, which we also think is going to shut. A very, very big deal. Tom Clements, are you with us?
Dave, Tom, you there?
Tom, you there? Okay, and then we have Dave Conrad. Dave Conrad, are you with us?
Hi, Harvey. Yes, I'm here.
All right, so Dave, you are talking to us from Santa Monica, California, or thereabouts, and
yes,
you are the son of the great Conrad cartoonist. I used to run his cartoons. I ran your dad's cartoons. I was the editorial director of the University of Michigan Daily back in 1966-67, and I loved his cartoons. I ran them on the editorial page as often as I possibly could. And you now are carrying on the torch here with a statue that was built based on one of his cartoons, as I understand it, but I'm not going to paraphrase you. You're the expert, so let's hear what you got to say about this statue in Santa Monica and what's going on.
Well, thanks for the nice things you said about my dad. I mean, he really was a pretty amazing journalist. A lot of people started their day with picking up the paper and looking at his cartoons. But there was something that he felt very, very strong about, that nuclear war and the nuclear bomb is the worst thing mankind has ever created. So he put up a statue in downtown Santa Monica at the Civic Center of a 26-foot-tall mushroom cloud that would happen, you know, from an atomic bomb dropping, but it's made out of giant chain links. And his point was, once one country fires off an atomic bomb, the chain reaction of other bombs going off would annihilate mankind. So he's got a reminder up telling us, let's never, ever have a nuclear bomb blast ever again. And I think what's unfortunate is nuclear bombs are as much a danger today as they ever been since they were invented. And kids today don't even know what a nuclear mushroom cloud looks like. They aren't aware of it. It's a danger that is there. And I think we need as many reminders as possible of that danger so that we don't get ourselves into trouble ever again with nuclear bombs.
All right, so describe this statue in detail, if you could, because I've been to Santa Monica many times, but I've never seen it. When is it built? What's it built out of, and where is it?
It's the 1800 block of Main Street in Santa Monica, and my dad wanted it in a civic center of a city, because his association is, of course, with government. So he's trying to show that government is the one that needs to be aware of this. It is 26 feet tall. It's a mushroom cloud. So in other words, it's a big base, comes up to a narrow point, and then a big mushroom cap on top of that. But it's made of giant copper chain links, very, very large copper chain links. You know, the structure inside is totally sound. It's made of steel and stainless steel and structural elements. And it's in somewhat disrepair, and that's the issue here, is that Santa Monica, the city, has said that they would like to remove the sculpture because it's in somewhat disrepair. We know
it probably costs more to move it than to fix it, right?
Yeah, moving it would be very difficult because it's very heavy, as you can imagine, 26 feet tall. Moving it would be tough because it's anchored into a cement base on the bottom. And I know my dad wanted to be in Santa Monica, wanted to be in a civic center, so moving it is like a last option, we think. It really makes the most sense to fix it right where it sits.
What would it cost to fix it up?
The city thinks it will cost as much as $400,000. We have an art conservator that says it'll cost as little as $100,000. We don't want to get into that right now. If we raise more money than is needed, then that's fine because there'll be upkeep to be done. Maybe they can add light so it looks good at night, things like that. So the number we're shooting for is $400,000. We do have a fundraiser at rally.org/savechainreaction, but the best place to go for information is conradprojects.com. We've got it in place. conradprojects.com. So CONRAD projects.com. That's got all the information. We've got a petition on change.org. We've got a Facebook page. You can all get to everywhere from conradprojects.com.
Well, okay. So how much money have you raised so far?
We have raised $15,000, and that's just the grassroots level. That's just, people making small donations. That's the local community supporting the statue. We're now, going after things like online crowdfunding, which like rally.org is. When You Wish is another crowdfunder we may be using. And we'll also go to art foundations and see if they would like to make bigger donations. But we still need the people, the grassroots, to speak out and say this is an important sculpture. Like I said, nuclear weapons are a big problem. The University of Chicago atomic scientists, that's the people who created the doomsday clock that says how close we are to annihilating the planet with bombs. That clock is closer to midnight than when my dad actually erected the sculpture. But do people know about, that was 20 years ago, I should have said that the sculpture was erected in 1991. Back then, people were very aware of nuclear threat. Now, with North Korea and like that, the threat is still there, but I don't think the people are as up in arms against this threat that is constantly over everyone's life. And that's why we think this sculpture is a very important reminder of that.
Well, it's interesting because I was a graduate student at the University of Chicago in 1967.
Okay.
And there was an unveiling in the fall of 67 at the site of the original, the first chain reaction, which was underneath the stadium at Stagg Field at the University of Chicago. And when they unveiled this Henry Moore statue, which is essentially an evocation of a mushroom cloud, there was a big demonstration. And right at the key moment that they were unveiling the statue, a guy who was standing next to me, Chris Hobson, I'll never forget this, yelled out, 150,000 Japanese are about to die. And this whole, all these guys in suits and this very, solemn occasion just kind of like went, whoa. That was the point. Now, the Henry Moore, of course, is very smooth and very easy to maintain. Exactly what's the – describe the disrepair that's on this statue. If it's only put in 1991, it's only been there 22 years.
Right. There's been some rusting on the interior structure. This structure is still fine, but they want to take care of the rust so it doesn't get worse. And it's kind of hard to reach in some places. So definitely they want to get inside, take care of any corrosion, any rust that's gone on. And the city, you know, I don't want to blame anyone. My father probably was part of this. Let people climb on it. The thing is open with no fence around it. So people have been climbing on it, pulling off the chain links, you know, just general wear and tear. And it's about, you know, 3 blocks from the ocean. So salt air has been part of it. So even though the structure's fine, they do want to get in there, get rid of the corrosion, check all the structural welds, and redo the chain links. And there's also the chain links sit on a fiberglass shell, and the fiberglass shell probably needs a new coating of some sort just because sun's been beating on it and, again, the salt air. So as far as I can tell, those are the repairs that need to get done is the corrosion on the inside, take care of the fiberglass, you know, coat that with ultraviolet protecting stuff, and then put the chain links back on. So, you know, it's a lot of cosmetic stuff, possibly some structural stuff, but those kind of repairs, you know. And then, you know, put some sort of garden or park around it so that people don't climb on it anymore. I think we all agree, the city and us, the supporters of it, agree that we don't need people climbing on it. That's just going to accelerate any wear and tear to the thing.
All right, very good. Dave Conrad, let me ask you, Tom Clemens, are you on the line here? Do we have Tom Clemens? Who else is on the line? Dave, you're still with us?
I'm here, yes.
Yes, okay.
Hey, Harvey. It's Glenn Carroll from Nuclear Watch South.
Okay, Glenn, I just wanted to make sure you and Tom were with us. I guess Tom's not yet, but I'm going to talk to you about Savannah River, okay, and also the Vogtle nuclear plant. So, Dave Conrad, if you'll repeat your website, and then if you will send me a paragraph on this with the website, I will post it with PRN and put it up on Facebook, and hopefully we can get some things going. And I'm going to be out there in the first week of August. Maybe we can arrange to have a rally of some sort. I'd love to do that at this monument. Well, have you had rallies at it?
We have, and we will have some more. Let me mention those if I could. On August 6th, at the chain reaction, at the sculpture itself, we will have a candlelight vigil. That is the day, the anniversary of Hiroshima, and we want to pay respect to the victims of the nuclear bomb. So
okay.
August 6th at the chain reaction, that's 1800 Main Street in Santa Monica. And then a couple weeks after that, the 18th at Bergamot Station in Santa Monica, we'll be having a fundraiser, an art auction, and just, you know, general information, awareness about nuclear arms and the statue itself. So all this information is at conradprojects.com. And you can go to facebook.com/savechainreaction. Like us, get information there. So the main thing is conradprojects.com. That's all the information. We would appreciate any support whatsoever, whether it be help or financial or anything. We really want to get this done. And I think it's cool that the community is coming together to make this happen, because this should belong to the community. It's public art.
Well, you should, what you need to do then is turn this into a more of a national, give this, I never heard of this statue before Diana Cohen emailed me and put me in touch with you. And so what we need to do is make this more of a national treasure, because your father, Conrad, the cartoonist, was certainly a national treasure. And I think that what we need to do is give this statue a more national stature. And so maybe we can do that. If you'll email me, we'll put it up. I'll put up, if you'll write an article about it, I'll put it up at nukec.org, and we'll see if we can't spread the word some more.
That will be great. I appreciate it so much, and thanks for all you've done, Harvey. I'm honored to be on your radio show.
Well, I'm good to have you on. I look forward to you sending me whatever you need to send, okay? Thank you so much, Conrad, and let's upgrade and move this statue to where it really needs to be in the public eye. So thanks again.
I look forward to meeting you in August. Thanks.
Be back in touch, Dave. Our next segment here, we're going to talk about nuclear power for the rest of the show, and specifically I'm going to talk to Glenn Carroll here. Glenn, you with us?
Yes, sir.
All right, Glenn. You are the rose of the Southern anti-nuclear movement here. You've been doing this. Well, we won't reveal your age, but you're not a teenager, let's put it that way.
Well, I still consider myself a newbie, Harvey, after 27 years.
27 years as an anti-nuclear activist, and you are in what city?
I'm in Atlanta.
Okay.
And of course, that's in Georgia, where Vogel, it's pronounced Vogel, is one of the pair of reactors that is under construction, the other being in South Carolina.
If you'd like to make a call, please hang up and try again.
Oh, dear.
If you need help, hang up and then dial your operator.
Why don't you just hang up and call us right back real quick? Let's go. It seems to be gone. Are you still with me?
If you'd like to make a call, please hang up and try it.
Occasionally, folks, we get the phone company and the NSA jump in. We get all sorts of interference on our phone lines. I'm not going to be a conspiracy theorist here, but this does happen fairly frequently. So Glenn Carroll is going to call us back from Atlanta, and later on in the show, we're going to have Micah Greer, A-G-U-I-R-R-E, talk to us about the challenge to the California Public Utilities Commission on the who's going to pay for San Onofre. San Onofre is the nuclear plant we've just shut down on the coast of California. Two big reactors, which are no longer operating, thank goodness. But the question is, who pays for it? The reason they're shut, aside from in addition to citizen action, is that they've installed steam generators that absolutely positively did not work. And they were looking at just $1 billion or so to fix them up. And the next thing you know, a grassroots movement rose up to stop them. And now, of course, Edison wants the ratepayers to pay. Glenn, are you back with us?
Yes.
You are. Okay, so let's continue with this. If the NSA jumps in again, we can just have you sign off and keep calling us back until it works. This does happen fairly frequently. So you have been involved, Glenn Carroll, one of my favorite activists, in fighting the Savannah River, among other things, not only Vogtle and the Summer Project in South Carolina, but also Savannah River, the plutonium, what we call it, enrichment, recycling, mixed oxide fuel boondoggle that has been going on for decades. How many billions of dollars have been poured into this sinkhole at Savannah River?
Well, it was originally going to cost $1.9 billion for the whole program. We're at $7.7 billion with projections.
That's a bit of rigor. Let me repeat that. Originally, Savannah River, which was going to convert weapons-grade plutonium into usable reactor fuel, am I correct?
Yes.
Was originally going to cost $1.9 billion. And when was this?
That would have been around maybe 1999 figures.
Oh, so it's actually not even that long ago. 1999.
Well, the program, you know, it's a treaty with Russia, but Russia didn't do their part. So, you know, it's a unilateral boondoggle now instead of a bilateral boondoggle.
Uh-huh.
And so costs are now at 7.7. I don't think we've spent that, but we're clearly, you know, that is the clear projection to finish the factory. If they actually did that and ran a program, they would spend $22 billion over the life of this
program.
Oh, my God.
All right, so let's review here. 1999, a project at Savannah River, joint with the Russians, to take plutonium weapons material, take them out of nuclear weapons, bring them to Savannah River, treat them in this chemical nuclear process. That was going to cause, and then use them for mixed oxide fuel, some of which, by the way, was present at Fukushima, and we can talk about that in a minute.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But and then that was getting $1.9 billion. The Russians backed out. It's now 2013, 14 years later, and the projected cost of this project, which has been under construction for a decade or more, is now $7.7 billion. So we went from $1.9 billion
to finish a factory to make fuel.
Just
and
then
if they actually make
fuel.
It would be $22 billion by the time they complete
the whole deal. Would be
$22
billion.
But now, this is the granddaddy of all boondoggles, Harvey. I mean, you say it's going to come out of a weapon. No, no, this never was even in a weapon. We made such an excessive amount of plutonium, 50 tons of plutonium, more than we could ever even put in a weapon. It's just sitting in a warehouse in Texas.
Where? Are we supposed to not know where it is?
No, it's in Pantex factory. Pantex. It's a weapons assembly facility in Amarillo, Texas.
All right, so let's review here. So this is actually not coming out of nuclear weapons. This is plutonium that they made for inventory that's sitting in Pantex. And how much is it?
Listen, you are giving them way too much credit, Harvey. They were insane. This is how we beat the Russians. They ran out of money before we did. We just went crazy. They called it the Ronnie Ray gun, right? They called Ronald Reagan Ronnie Ray gun because he was like going crazy making nuclear weapons stuff. And so we have
They manufactured all this plutonium, never put it in nuclear weapons, and it's still sitting at Pantex in Texas. And how much is there?
And all, we're talking about 50 tons of plutonium. I want you to wrap your mind around that. That is 100,000 pounds. And it only takes 15 pounds to make a weapon.
It takes 15 pounds. Let's be generous. Let's say it takes 20 pounds to make a weapon, a nuclear weapon, which would be three times as much as was used on Nagasaki.
Let's be conservative and say we got 50,000 nuclear weapons worth of plutonium.
So we have enough plutonium to make 50,000 nuclear weapons. And Obama, to his credit, is struggling to bring the number down to 1,000 that we have in our inventory. But we have enough to make how many thousand weapons?
Well, it's actually something in the order of 63,000 when you get really precise about it. But
I feel much more secure knowing that. Don't you feel a lot more secure knowing that we have enough plutonium to make 63,000 nuclear weapons? We could probably crack the planet if we blew them all up at once, couldn't we?
But you know, Harvey, meanwhile, we shut down Rocky Flats near Denver where they made these triggers, and we turned that into a wildlife refuge. And they had a whole bunch of crumbs and crumbles and little pieces, and it's just all a big old mishmash. I like to call it junk plutonium. Well, they cleaned up that facility by bringing the plutonium to Savannah River. So we haven't even got the triggers, the uniform weapons components there yet. We've got junk from, I'm getting a call. I wonder if that's Tom. He'll call you eventually. We cleaned up Rocky Flats by sending the plutonium to Savannah River, and I'm being specious. We did not clean it up. It's contaminated, and they've turned it into a wildlife refuge. We have decontaminated Hanford by bringing the plutonium, the junk plutonium, to Savannah River, and we cleaned up a lab in California. And so we have something in the order of 16 tons of junk plutonium that's in various states at Savannah River. So we are far from ready to open up a factory. We don't even know what's in these little cans of 9 pounds each.
Wow. That's pretty devastating.
Okay, now, hold that thought. The way we secure this plutonium is it has to go into a reactor. That is the game plan. When it goes into a reactor, it's going to turn into that extremely hot spent nuclear fuel, you know, the kind of stuff that you, like, need a mountain to put it in or something, right? You know, it's going to be a new form of that same obnoxious stuff we were going to put in Yucca Mountain. Well, there are no reactors that are willing to use this stuff. So even if they finished the factory and started making fuel, there's nobody to irradiate it. So Ed Lyman with Union of Concerned Scientists called it the factory to nowhere.
Wow. Now, tell us now, what is happening with this facility? What is the possibility that it's not going to go forward?
Well, you know what? We have been toiling away. We have been raising the issue. We've been arguing about it over at the reactor level. We argue about it when they truck the stuff around. It's a French design we're doing. So they've been sending plutonium back and forth to France. And now suddenly we are, you know, having a recession. We're as broke as, you know, we're just beyond broke. And I give Tom Clements a lot of credit for bulldogging Congress and finally getting it noticed that this is a place where we can clearly cut corners and save money. So now they're talking seriously cutting the budget by half, figuring out how to bring the program down, and looking again at the alternatives, which were, you know, what we advocated, you know, over 15 years ago. We were advocating it's a waste. We have too much. It's a waste. And ironically, the way we got it, Harvey, was we were running it through reactors. We ran uranium through reactors at the weapons complex, and it turns into plutonium. And we melted it, and we got all the hot stuff that if it was spent commercial nuclear fuel, they would want to put in a mountain or somewhere. We've got that in 60-year-old tanks at Savannah River site. It's hot. And we say the program for that, it's a liquid waste, and it's in these leaking old underground tanks. And the program is to turn it into glass. And we say, put that plutonium in there. You know, it's a perfect program. We made the plutonium at Savannah River site. We have all the nuclear waste that's left over from that. You know, they can be brought back together in a really good waste program. So anyway, we're about to embark on examining options like that again.
Sounds good. So what is going to happen at Savannah River? What's going to happen? How much work has been done, and what's going to happen to what's been done there? And what is the future of that project? My understanding is that the South Carolina delegation, the senator, the congresspeople, Lindsey Graham, very powerful delegation, are resisting any cuts in this Savannah River project, and they want to push forward despite all the obvious pitfalls.
Well, that's right. Now, they call it the factory 60% complete, which is a figure they've been using for about 10 years now. And Lindsey Graham is very determined, and I keep noticing, though, that high-powered media like the New York Times are running headlines about how the U.S. is going to abandon this factory. And we're kind of scratching our heads and waiting and wondering and hoping. And I'm sort of guessing that he's using his clout to bargain for other things, like he just came down on a side we disagree with about immigration, and he may be throwing his weight around, and this may be a lost cause. I don't know. I went to one of the periodic, it's a nuclear regulatory commission regulated site, even though it's at the Department of Energy nuclear weapons site, because this fuel it would make would go into commercial reactors, which the NRC regulates. The NRC is regulating this factory. So I went to one of the quarterly meetings, and I was sort of encouraged that the talk was, how are y'all going to, you know, approach closing this up so that if it ever was to, you know, be returned to, it would be in good shape. And, you know, my suggestion was, Harvey, you know, they're talking about covering up Fukushima with a very heavyweight, like, garbage bag type of plastic. If they think they can keep radiation inside a ruined nuclear reactor with a big old garbage bag, I think they can keep the birdies and the rain out of this unfinished MOX factory with a big old garbage bag. So that was my suggestion.
Yeah, right. All right. We're talking with Glenn Carroll from Atlanta, Georgia, talking about the Savannah River nuclear project meant to convert weapons-grade plutonium into usable reactor fuel. Was there some, we call it MOX, M-O-X, mixed oxide fuel. Was there some of this stuff at Fukushima, Glenn? And what happened? My understanding is that there was some mixed oxide fuel in Unit 3, which did explode, and that the radiation that came out of there was more serious than from the other reactors. Are you aware of this situation?
Well, yes, and I'm sure you were like me. You woke up, you heard about the tsunami, And, you know, Harvey, in Solartopia, I remember you wrote about the march of meltdowns that led, you know, to the wake-up call that made us change the practice we made of energy. And I remember being a little upset by it because, you know, I just really, really hope that we can wake up without suffering such an extreme radiation poisoning of our whole entire planet. And then we lost 3 reactors in March. And I thought that was it. That was the March of Meltdowns that you sort of foresaw. Anyway, that one, and you could watch them practically live on YouTube. It was so creepy. And that one had black smoke. And what the reason that smoke was black was because it contained plutonium. And yet, even though it had plutonium, and that was horrific, and they've been finding plutonium all over the place, activist pressure was already so great against MOX fuel in Japan that had been scheduled to be loaded with 40% core of plutonium, and they had been held up so much it was just a 5% experimental core. I mean, it could have been far, far, far worse, which is kind of hard to imagine, isn't it, Harvey?
It is. Now, my understanding is that people like you and the Nuclear Information Resource Service, and of course people in Japan, did successfully prevent still more MOX fuel from being put into the reactor at Fukushima, and that therefore the plutonium releases weren't quite as bad as they might have been.
That's right.
So is that actually a true story? And what kind of pressure did it take to keep the MOX fuel down at Fukushima?
Well, you know, the Japanese protests are quite visible and very acknowledged now, but they were pretty intense protests beforehand, and particularly about the MOX, because there they were planning on doing MOX. You know, our weapons-based MOX was really a grand experiment, but other places on the planet it's been dabbled in, and that's been by taking the commercial spent nuclear fuel where the uranium is turned into plutonium and a whole host of really, really hot byproducts like iodine and cobalt and strontium and cesium, and they separate it and get the plutonium out and make this MOX fuel. And they've done this in England and in Japan, excuse me, in France. And Japan, which is notoriously, you know, an energy-poor country because they don't have oil and coal and all that nasty, poisonous stuff. They got plenty of sun and wind and wave power. But anyway, they were building the Rokusho reprocessing facility where they were going to extract plutonium and remanufacture it into MOX fuel, and it's been incredibly controversial, and so much mm-hmm. so that activist pressure had kept the reactor core down to 5% experimental core. I mean, they had delayed the project and just brought a lot of pressure. If they had not stepped up and done anything, it would have had the 40% core they were intending to do, and it would have been far worse.
Amazing. We're talking with Glenn Carroll again, another tribute to the power of activism. The reality is that plutonium releases at Fukushima would have been much, much worse had there not been citizen opposition to the use of this stuff. Glenn, you've been an activist for 27 years. What's the name of your group in Atlanta?
Nuclear Watch South. And you can look us up at nonukesyall.org.
Very good. Now, tell us further here about what's going on in South Carolina and Georgia with the two commercial reactors there, the Votel. How do you talk about it in Georgia?
Vogel. The T is silent.
Vogel.
And then
you don't pronounce the T.
Don't pronounce the T. So there are two Westinghouse-designed reactors under construction in Georgia at Plant Vogel. There are two same design under construction in South Carolina called Summer. And the same contractors are building both. And, in fact, the same contractor that's been building the Mox factory, and they're making the same mistakes. They're installing the rebar wrong, and they're messing up the concrete pour, and they're using non-certified parts suppliers. And, Harvey, they have figured out how to make money. I don't think they're going to ever finish these things, but they are going to make a lot of money messing around.
Well, what's the status of the loan guarantees now? The feds were supposed to give loan guarantees to the Southern Company to build Vogtle and, I guess, Vogtle, Plant Vogtle. I'll pronounce it the way you do, and to follow up on Summer. Although Summer, I guess, which companies are building which? And who is the one to get the total
guarantee? They're all building this AP1000 Westinghouse reactor design. And Southern Company and Vogel were a few months ahead of Summer. And seems like maybe the heat was a little too much on Southern Company, and they kind of, you know, bowed their head a little bit and let Summer take precedence. I'm pretty sure Summer poured their concrete first. Because Vogel and Southern Company were getting into all kind of trouble, you know, getting all these notices of violation and making a lot of mistakes. Now, they both were eligible, I think, for loan guarantees, but Summer said they did not need them. And Vogel... Well, Harvey, what is really going down is in both Georgia and South Carolina, the residential electric customers are paying for these up front. And it's a concept called QIP, Construction Work in Progress. And I'm much more familiar with what's going on in Georgia, but apparently South Carolina is getting enough. You know, on their electric bills, they're getting enough money that they have said they don't need loan guarantees. Now, meanwhile, over in Georgia, I have gotten intimately familiar with this QIP charge. And you asked, how are the loan guarantees going? Well, first of all, does everybody know what a loan guarantee is? That would be a loan directly from the U.S. Treasury to Southern Company, which is one of the richest and largest companies on the planet, one of the biggest utilities in the world. It's privately owned. In Georgia, it's getting an 11.15% return on equity, which translates into automatic profits. And so they want to borrow money from the U.S. Treasury. Now, they have just missed the deadline again. It's been extended to September. We're very encouraged. Every time, you know, this deadline is passed, the terms they were seeking were kept secret. Other organizations have managed to pry some of the information out. They apparently are wanting to borrow this money for 0% interest. Now, this is our money.
Yeah, and now, what's happened here is that the, and correct me if I'm wrong, because this is a story of national importance. We're talking with Glenn Carroll.
Hello?
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 Yes, is this Glenn?
Yes.
Yes, Glenn. Okay, it's Harvey. We're back again.
Oh, good.
Back on the
call-in show.
Yes, we're back on the Philadelphia Green Power and Wellness Show. We're talking with Glenn Carroll in Georgia on the question of the nuclear power plants in Georgia. We've had a long discussion about the Savannah River plutonium facility, and now we're going to talk a little more about Plant Vogtle and the VC Summer plant.
Yes.
So go ahead and tell us, what is the status of these two reactors that are being built in the southeast?
Well, they are not going well, Harvey. We have been constructing Plant Vogel for about 18 months. It's already 15 months behind officially, and almost $1 billion over budget officially. We had a big showdown at the state legislature last year where the Tea Party got involved. We have been waiting for the Tea Party to notice, you know, that nuclear should not be something that they are fond of. And we were tackling the fact that Georgia Power can actually make a profit on its cost overruns. And we are now suspicious that they have no incentive to bring the project in on time and under budget.
Well, tell us why. Why do they have no incentive to bring down the cost?
Because they have been given automatic profits by the Georgia Public Service Commission.
Explain that.
Well, you know, they were down there. We're all down there all the time. It's kind of an obscure venue, but it's one of the places where if you want to stop a nuclear plant, you have to go. And Georgia Power explained that if they went out of business, that we would all, you know, be in the dark. And so they have this sweet deal where they get automatic profits, and that's part of, you know, ensuring their health. The other thing, this is kind of really interesting, a little hand-in-glove thing. They were arguing that if they didn't look really pristine on paper, they would not qualify for the loan guarantees, and so they needed all of this construction work in progress with
so
money that we're paying up front so that their bottom line would look good, so they would qualify for a real good deal with the, you know, loan from the U.S. Treasury.
Well, tell us exactly, Glenn, what is construction work in progress? It's turned up at other nuclear plants around the country, and it was a factor at Seabrook. And so please explain to us what this means.
Well, in the first wave of reactor build, which went down in the mostly in the 70s, and I think you were super involved at Seabrook, right?
Yeah.
They did pass that in New Hampshire, but they repealed it. And, in fact, we borrowed the rallying cry, quip is a rip, and are attempting to do that here. Nobody passed that in the country. We successfully fought that battle in Georgia. They fought it in Missouri. They fought it in California. I think it was proposed in something like 17 states, and nobody passed it except New Hampshire. And New Hampshire even repealed it. Well, then, in, you know, here recently, we started going through it again. And Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina have passed it. North Carolina has held it at bay. Iowa has held it off. Missouri has held it off. In Florida, it was really crazy because there, where they've also shut another reactor, you were talking about San Onofre earlier, and Crystal River is never going to operate again. They botched a steam generator repair. You know, same sort of deal as in San Onofre, but it was a different deal. They botched the concrete patch, and they've spent like $1.9 billion, and it's still not right, and they've decided to abandon it. But meanwhile, they were planning to build a new reactor, and they started charging quip, and then they postponed the new reactor indefinitely. And they just recently passed a law saying, well, you can't collect this quip money anymore. They were continuing to collect the quip money, even though they announced about a year ago they weren't going to build the new reactor. So here we are in Georgia and South Carolina, and this is sort of our reason for being lately. Our main approach to stopping Vogtle is to make people aware of this quip tax. And hope to get a different legislature. It was several years ago. It's new people. Georgia Power has not brought the bargain that it sold everybody. And so we're hoping we can get the legislature to repeal it.
What are your chances?
I think they're very good.
Starting when?
Well,
how are you going to
do
that?
Okay, it's we just did this integrated resource plan. I guess they do these in a lot of states. And every 3 years, Georgia Power, which is a regulated monopoly, rolls out a 20-year vision. And so this year they showed up, and it didn't have any solar or wind power in it. And we have a solid all five members of our Public Service Commission are Republicans. And a couple of them, for sure, are mandating solar. And we're going to find out on Thursday which way the vote's going to go. And the reporters are pretty much predicting that Georgia Power is going to be mandated to put 500 megawatts of solar online. And the Tea Party, again, has gotten really involved. And they're grumbling about the QIP money, and they're being very pro-solar. And the
Tea Party is being pro-solar?
Yes. Yes, it's making national news. And just over the weekend, this Koch brothers front group called Americans for Prosperity started coming out going, no, solar will drive our rates through the roof. I'm like, y'all, come on, get a clue. You know, Vogel is guaranteed to drive our rates through the roof. You know?
Well, but the Koch brothers
solar
are...
is cheap now. It's gotten cheap.
Well, this is kind of a strange development because the Koch brothers are very, very deeply invested in fossil fuels. And my understanding has been that the Tea Party has basically been their lapdog. Are you saying now that the Tea Party is opposing the Koch brothers?
We have two factions, and we've had two factions for a while. And the first faction we heard from, and the ones that were down there with us complaining that we had a bill, and it's going to come back. But it's really frustrating because nuclear has become like a religion in Georgia, and if you go down there and you're anti-nuclear, you might as well have said you were a Nazi or something. I mean, you just got to keep a rap on that. But, you know, they were complaining because there's no limit. They were just trying to have a bill that said when you get over the estimated cost of the nuclear reactor, Vogel, you can go ahead and recover your costs, they were saying. You just can't make a profit on it. We just need to limit your profits because you have sort of this upside-down incentive. Like, the more you spend on the program, the more money you're going to make, and we need to, you know, fix that. So the Tea Party was very vocal down there. And then here recently with this integrated resource plan, when the couple of the Republican commissioners started, you know, bringing the hammer down and saying, you guys need to get with the program and build some solar, the Tea Party was down there really strongly supporting that.
Well, that's really unheard of, Glenn. I got to tell you, I spoke to a Tea Party group here in Columbus, Ohio, a couple of years ago, and it was fun because I was looking at these 60 people, and I'm the Greenpeace guy, and, you know, it was like being a black people person at a Klan rally in the 1860s. But nonetheless, so actually what I did was I diverted their attention and started my talk by advocating legal marijuana. Got a lot of blank stares and actually some friendly reactions. But they were just adamantly against any form of renewable energy. And,
well,
and
I know. But I think what happened here was this QIP tax, this construction work in progress tax. And, I mean, you know, we were starting down the road to that. And on Vogel 1 and 2, which were built, you know, in the 60s and 70s and 80s, it went on for 20 years, and that one was notorious because it was 1,200% cost overruns. We had, like, steel companies that were on our side because it was, you know, going to ruin Georgia as an industrial base to have these, you know, skyrocketing rates. And this time Georgia Power made a deal with their industrial customers and also with their large retail customers like Target and Walmart. Oh, my God. Harvey, Walmart is getting into solar. They want to get off the grid. They're putting solar panels on their, you know, big box stores. It is truly solartopia.
Well, that's amazing. I know about Walmart, actually. I wish they'd change their labor policies along with their energy policies.
Well,
but,
I know.
Walmart does seem to be committing to going to renewables. It's pretty amazing. And I'm really stunned. I'm stunned to hear that the Tea Party in any state of this country is backing renewables. They have been completely in the pocket of the Koch brothers and completely anti-wind and solar. And now you're telling me that in Georgia, they're coming out for renewables. That's a stunner.
It is a stunner. It makes me very happy. I mean, you know, when we took on Quip and we've, you know, been strategizing about this with some, you know, pretty knowledgeable people, and they were like, you know, you really got to tone down the anti-nuclear rhetoric. You need, you know, a broad coalition. You need to get the AARP involved because, you know, these people, old people paying for a power plant that may never come online, you know, and they're on a fixed income. It's just really, really unfair. And well, we've been thinking the Tea Party should hate nuclear because of the subsidies, you know, during this whole renaissance. I mean, Tom, I'm sorry Tom didn't make it today, and I hope he's okay, but Tom and his...
Well, he'll be okay. I got an email from him.
Oh.
But the fact is that, is there any other state where the Tea Party has gone pro-solar? Because if it's true, it would be a huge turnaround and be a big help in our march to Solartopia.
Well, it sure would, and they did the, what was it, you remember in Alice in Wonderland, they dressed up like the characters from Alice in Wonderland and went to a Tea Party rally a couple of years ago. But it's made the national news, what's going on in Georgia, and the fact that there's a Republican Public Service Commission poised to mandate solar is just really, I can't explain it. I'm very, very happy about it, Harvey, but it's hard to explain. And, you know, you and I know that as we've watched the nuclear renaissance evaporate and it's got a toehold in Georgia and South Carolina only because of the Quip, meanwhile, solar has become cheaper. Solar and wind, I mean, wind has always been cheaper. Renewables are contributing more to the energy mix globally and nationally than nuclear is. We've shut 4 reactors this year. The trend is pretty good.
It is good. And we've got more to come. I think more and more reactors can be shut down. We've got 3 down this year. 4 down this year, actually. And now we're coming back to Solartopia. Glenn Carroll, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you, Harvey.
Much appreciated. It's been a good show with you, and we will be talking to you as the more and more reactors shut down. This has been a great hour with the Solartopia Green Power Woman Show, and we'll see you again next week to talk about dollarocracy.
Solartopia, Solartopia, don't you know?